help me to welcome our speaker tonight, which is Mariel from Point Pleasant, New Jersey, from the Shrewsbury Wednesday night meeting. Me to come out. I get really anxious like the first minute or two that I talk, so it caught me a little slack. It's a Friday date. It's May 7th, 2007, so it's been over 6.5 years. Through the grace of God, absolutely, through good sponsorship, through the 12 steps, and through a fellowship with Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor, she is a sponsor, and I have a home group, and I am honored to be able to sponsor some other women. So, I was here about a month or two ago with one of the girls I sponsor, and we got lost on the way home. We ended up in Princeton, and I live in Point Pleasant. So, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning we got home. So I'm hoping that my departure this evening will be a little bit better. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do, and I guess I could start there. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous and the life that has been given to me, over the last 6.5 years. When I got here, I was not the same person that you see standing in front of you. I was broken. I was in so much pain. I was desperate. I was lonely. I was terrified. I wasn't even a woman or a girl. I was a shell of a human being. That's how I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I also walked into Alcoholics Anonymous homeless, with a big book, a couple changes of clothes, and a teddy bear. I was a very low bottom drunk, and that's my experience. And what I've been taught is, I'm here to share with you my experience. And my experience is I was a very low bottom drunk. But I will share with you some knowledge that I gained through good sponsorship and going through the big book line by line, word by word, page by page, is that me being a low bottom drunk is not what makes me alcoholic, and you being a high bottom drunk is not what makes you alcoholic. You do not need to be homeless, prostituting, stealing, setting fires. Like, you don't need to be doing that stuff to come to AA or to be alcoholic. You could live in a beautiful 5-bedroom house with, 3 cars in the garage and a boat, and you could still be alcoholic. From my experience, though, is that I'm a very low bottom drunk. And I went through a long period of time in Alcoholics Anonymous where I didn't talk too much about my drinking, because I'm very big book schooled and big book oriented, and we don't talk about war stories. We're all about the solution. And I was very effective, and I think that's very effective. For my experience is that. When I was new, I wasn't listening to the people who were talking about God, who wanted to hear about God, I was listening to the people who were talking about drinking, I was listening to the people who were talking about being broken, and that's what I was attracted to, when I first got there. I don't remember hearing anything for the first, however long it was. It was a woman that I heard that was talking from the podium. She had about 10 years sober, and she was talking about being in a crack house with rats crawling over her and her kids in the other room, and I got that, I got that. And when she said that, I had this moment of, I'm not worse than everybody here, and that there's a chance, for me to get sober and live the same life that you guys all appear to be living, which was a lot of what I didn't get. I got here with so much shame and so much guilt, and feeling so apart from, and it's through an identification with another woman at the podium who had the humility to be gut-wrenchingly honest about her past, I was able to identify in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I think, you know, if you're anything like me, you know, I suffer from tremendous syndrome. And what I've learned over the last, whatever, amount of years is that ego separates me from you. It doesn't necessarily make me feel like a piece of crap. It can also make me feel like I'm the queen of the world, you know? But what it does is it separates me from you. You know, and I'll just say quickly, because I already know I mentioned the crack house. You know, drugs are a big part of my story. I smoked crack once for 2 years. I love drugs, you know, but what I also love, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I respect the tradition to hold us together as a fellowship. And so what I know is that my experience with drugs, you know, are to be touched on in the podium, but are much more left to be talked about one-on-one with somebody. And what I do believe is I believe that if you're alcoholic the way that I'm alcoholic, you will need anything or anybody to feel okay. You know, I do not drink because I like the taste of booze. I drink because I like the effect that's produced by it. You know, I don't believe that alcohol is ever my problem or drugs. They were my solution. You know, so the reason why I got intoxicated was because I was looking for something outside of me to make me feel okay. And, you know, and that's what I found in alcohol and other substances. You know, so I'm going to tell you a quick little story about when I was a kid. And if you've ever heard me speak before, which some of you have, I'm sure you've heard this story because I always tell it. But I really believe I could tell the story and I could sit down. You know, I think it sums up my alcoholism and my spiritual malady in a way that, you know, is incomparable. So I was a little girl growing up in New York City, and this elderly woman babysat me, and she was fabulous. She did everything in her power, her human power, to make me okay. You know, she loved me, she fed me, she bathed me, she clothed me, she played with me. You know, she's fabulous. But what happened is there would come a point where whatever she was giving me was not enough. You know, and I live forwards, I understand backwards. So I had no idea what my motives were for doing this when I was 5, 6, 7 years old. But what I would do is I would take her glasses and I would hide them. And since she needed her glasses to see, she noticed that they were missing eventually. And she would ask me to help her look for them. And obviously, since I hid them, I always found them. And what happened is when I found her glasses, she would shower me with love and attention and praise, you know, which was, in that moment, what I needed to feel okay, you know. And again, I'll say it very clearly, I live forward and I understand backwards. So I had no idea that I suffered from a spiritual malady and I was looking for a human power to make me feel okay. You know, like, I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know I had to disconnect from myself and you and God. Like, if you'd asked me when I was 5, I wouldn't have told you that. If you'd asked me when I was 20, I wouldn't have told you that. You know? But I knew that I was okay. And so I took whatever measures necessary in my little 5-year-old head that I could figure out to make myself feel okay. And I'm, like I said, I could sit down, because that's my story. Drunk or sober, you know, I'm looking to human powers to make me feel okay, you know, because I am not okay. And, you know, if I could have found alcohol in kindergarten, that would have been fabulous, you know, like, kindergarten was hard, you know, and I mean that, like, I don't have, like, tons of memories, but I just remember everything was hard, you know, everything was hard, and I just wasn't okay. You know, and I'm not saying that to anyone, any sort of self-pity or even empathy from you guys. That's just my experience and my truth. I am not okay. You know, and being me was hard. Like, from the little things, you know, like picking out an outfit, you know, or starting the car or ordering a drink at Starbucks. Like, just life was difficult. You know, and I suffered from this constant unease, you know, this constant dis-ease. You know, I felt like there was a knot in my, you know, in my gut and in my chest. I felt like, you know, I didn't even feel like it. I knew for a fact that I was not as good as you. You know, I'm lonely. I could be in, you know, a room with this many people. I could be in a room with 1,000 people. And I still felt alone. Like, the kind of loneliness that, like, hurts in your bones, you know? That just, you ache because you're so alone. You know, I was fearful of everyone and everything, you know? And I was just in pain, you know? And if you felt the way I would feel, you would be looking for something to make you feel okay, too. You know, and I talk a lot about my spirituality because, one, I believe that's how we identify. You know, because my drinking and your drinking may be very different. You know, however, if you're alcoholic, then you've probably suffered from some of the same feelings that I felt, which come and spring from spirituality. You know, I don't have a first drink story. Sometimes I wish I did, like I want to make one up from the podium that's really like sexy or scary, because I want you guys to like me. And I just don't have one, you know. I don't remember that first drink. You know, I used to have a song that talked about, you know, her first drink. You know, she got seducted and naked, and that's how the rest of her drinking went. You know, that's pretty close to my story. What I do remember from a young age, though, is drinking for the effect. You know, I remember going into Mom's liquor cabinet, and I remember, like, taking a little bit from every single bottle, you know, so there's no good taste in that. Like, I'm talking about mixing, like, vermouth and sherry and peach schnapps and tequila. Like, that's the mix I'm talking about. And if any of you are drinkers here, you know that those do not taste good together, you know? So I remember having, like, this little Tupperware, and mixing it all together and drinking the whole thing, even though it tasted terrible. You know, that's not normal drinking. You know, it's just not normal drinking. And I drank as much as I could, as fast as I could, and that is how I drank, from the very beginning to the very end. And you know, I don't have a lot of alcohol or drugs-related consequences as a kid, you know. But I do have a lot of consequences based upon my spirituality, you know. I remember, you know, being dragged from doctor to doctor, you know, with my poor mother trying to figure out what the hell was wrong with me, you know. And I remember being given medication and snorting it. I remember, you know, I remember having night terrors. I remember, you know, wetting the bed until I was, you know, I don't even know how old, but longer than I should have. All of these things I was doing because I was not okay. You know, when I was 13, my mom took us out of New York City because I had gotten out of control. I was stealing, I was truant, I was lying, I was unaccountable. And they were already in a precarious situation. And my mom figured that if she could get me out of New York City, you know, things might be a little bit better. And so we went to a small, upper middle class town in Connecticut. And I'll tell you, by Christmas of my freshman year, I was expelled from school. I actually stole my guidance counselor's wallet, and apparently they frown upon that. I don't know. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff I did. And then I was homeschooled, then I was tutored, and, you know, I was sent to a wilderness program, and I was sent to a boarding school. You know, and again, living forward, understanding backwards, what that speaks to me today is that no human power is my answer. You know, because my mom, and God bless my mother, like, you know, the things I put her through and the lengths she went to try and protect me. You know, what my mother was doing was trying to get me help. you know, through the therapist, through the boarding school, through, you know, whatever it was. And no human power was enough. You know, so I'll tell you a little bit about my drinking. You know, I love to drink and I love to get high. You know, and I'm so grateful for alcohol because, like I told you, being me is really hard. You know, and the solution that I have found in alcohol, I believe absolutely saved my life. Because it was so hard to be me that I probably would have killed myself if I hadn't found something to make me feel okay. You know, and not to say that I wasn't slowly killing myself, you know, but I found some sort of relief. You know, and that's all I'm looking for. You know, whether it's in the stealing or the bedwetting or the, you know, or the sleeping around or the drink. I'm just looking to feel okay. And you know, so the beginning of my drinking was a lot of fun, guys. You know, like I have a lot of fond memories of the first year I was drinking really hard. You know, hotel parties and hanging out with kids I thought were my friends, and you know, just come alive in a way that I hadn't felt my whole life senior year of high school. And you know, again, living forward and understanding backward. And I know I say that all the time, but it's so important for me. You know, Socrates says, an unexamined life is a life not worth living. And I don't understand almost anything when I'm about to do it. It's always through hindsight in 2020 that I understand. And so, senior year, I would have told you that I was like just an average high school girl drinking. However, I will tell you that I woke up one morning at about 4 o'clock with a wrapping on the back of my Honda Civic's window, and I was covered in my vomit with my pants around my legs, you know, and the clutch on my car had gone out, and I had been left there with alcohol poisoning, you know. So even at 17, you know, like, that's not normal drinking, you know, and I didn't see that, you know, I didn't see that. And what I will also tell you, just to give you a picture of my character, or lack thereof, is the next week I was hanging out with the same kids that left me in that car underneath the bridge that burned out my clutch. You know, and why? Because I just wanted to have some life and be so badly. You know, and I was so full of self-loathing and self-hatred and, you know, knowing factually that I was less than you. You know, I just wanted to be a part of. That's all I wanted. You know, and I still suffer from that. You know, I'd be lying if I said I didn't care what you guys think about me. I absolutely do. It's just not paralyzing anymore. And, you know, so it says in the big book that, you know, especially women do not need to drink as much or for as long as other people to become the real deal alcoholic. And I do not have, you know, 30 years of experience drinking. I have about 4. To be honest with you, I've been sober longer than I've been drinking. And what my experience is, though, is that by the end of that 4 years, I'm just okay, you know? And the consequences for me had escalated to a point that were outrageous. And if you're new here and you haven't been drinking for that long, or someone has the gall to tell you, you know, like, you know, I've spilled more alcohol than you've ever drank, like, in the kindest way, like, God bless them, you know, because do not allow anyone to steal your seat here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I truly believe that we do not get here by accident, and sobriety days are God-given, you know, so if you're here, there's probably a reason. You may have to leave us, you know, but if you're here, there's probably a reason, you know, and so my drinking escalated. And I can tell you, like, a couple things that happened. Like, I got kicked out of school, college, for punching my roommate. I was in various abusive relationships. I ended up getting into another college and started getting involved in some very illegal drugs. And if you smoke crack, you probably know the story's over pretty soon after you started smoking crack. And what happened is I began to live a life that I didn't even know was possible to live. You know, a life of homelessness, a life of prostitution, a life of desolation, a life of just guilt and shame and remorse all the time for the things that I was doing. And, you know, 6 months prior, I was like an upper middle class, you know, college student with a little Jetta and a cell phone, you know, and you know, 6 months later, I'm homeless, being pimped out by my fiance, you know, in the hood of Norwalk. And I would have told you that I didn't know any other way. It also says in our doctor's opinion that the alcoholic life is the only normal life that we know. And that absolutely is my experience. My experience was I surrounded myself with people that drank like I drank, and I didn't for a second question that what I was doing was not normal. You know, whereas 2 years prior, you know, I would have told you that like, prostitution wasn't even a real thing, you know, like it happened in movies. You know, like, I just had no idea. You know, so by the time I got here, you know, I'm sure that stuff with you from the podium because, one, I have no shame about it anymore. Like, I don't go home and have nightmares about being raped. I don't have to go home and, you know, feel like crap about myself because of the things that I did or the person I was. I really come to peace with that the things I did not make me who I was. They were just things that I did. And all of those things I needed to go through to become the person I am today. And that wasn't, however, the way I felt when I got here. Okay? Like I said, I felt broken. And I was full of guilt and shame and remorse. And so much of that is why I continued to drink at the end. You know, like, alcohol was not working for me at the end. And it talks about that in our big book, too, this jumping all the place. You know, where we can't imagine life with the drink and we can't imagine it without. And toward the end, there was no, like, martinis with my pinky raised. Like, toward the end, I was in a fetal position in a crack motel with a bottle in my hand, you know, drinking while sobbing, you know, because it wasn't working. But I didn't have any other solution. You know, I just didn't have any other solution. And having flashes of all the terrible things that I'd done, and all the terrible things that had happened to me. I was raped once brutally at gunpoint and held hostage afterwards. Like, how do people recover from that? You know, like, without drinking. You know, without drinking. Like, at the end, I was so broken, and there was so much that I had shame about that I needed to drink. And at the end, also, the drink wasn't doing it for me. You know, the drink wasn't doing it for me. I still felt broken. I still felt shattered. I felt so alone, and I felt so terrified. You know, like, if I thought I was a piece of crap when I was 12, like, I certainly thought I was a piece of crap when I was 19. And when I got here, and I'll tell you one more thing, you know, which is so important, about what I believe distinguishes the common drinker from the alcoholic, and what I believe, you know, is so important to understand is a mental obsession. You know, because when I got here, I didn't understand why I was such a terrible human being. You know, like, I just thought I was bad. I thought there was no way to get better, you know, no way to, I just thought that's who I was. And what I've been taught is that the most dangerous time for me is when I'm sober. You know, that I looked at all of these people around me that loved me, and there weren't that many towards the end, you know, but like my mother with tears streaming down her face, like 30 pounds underweight because she's so full of anxiety. You know, every time the phone rings, it's going to be the morgue or the police or whatever, you know. She begged me to stop drinking. And I wouldn't be able to tell her that I would. You know, I'd have, like, you know, a fiance telling me if I didn't change my actions, you know, he wouldn't leave me. And I wouldn't stop. You know, I had legal ramifications. I had, you know, a miscarriage in the hotel because I didn't want to leave and go to the hospital because I didn't want to stop drinking. You know, like, what kind of human being is like that? You know, and like, that's the way I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Not understanding, you know, thinking I was just a piece of crap, you know, and thank God for the women in the fellowship who came before me, you know, that are armed with the facts, not just of the big book, but also with themselves. Because what my first sponsor did is she talked to me about me while talking to me about her. And she explained to me what I suffered from. And I truly believe that, like, there's two eras in our life. I believe there was the error before the doctor's opinion, and I believe there was the error after the doctor's opinion. And the reason why I believe that is I believe that once I was armed with the facts about what I suffered from, you know, without even doing inventory and all of having a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, like, my perception already was able to shift. My perception, I was already able to see things differently than I walked in the door with. You know, I was able to have a little bit of understanding about why I did the things I did and who I was. You know, the things that I was told about, you know, just having a phenomenon of craving, an allergy, and I understood that. You know, having a mental obsession, you know, which means that it doesn't matter. You know, I'm obsessed with the idea of drinking, and that obsession overshadows anyone I can drink. You know, and that makes sense to me. You know, and then the spiritual malady, you know, and that really makes sense to me. You know, that this brokenness I felt inside of me, you know, was real. And also the solution. You know, and I share that with you because that's really important. You know, it's really important that there was a solution. Because when I met her, I didn't think there was. You know, I hoped that maybe what you guys had would work. You know, but I really didn't think there was a solution. And like I told you, like, I'm a solution drinker. I drink, or I have sex, or I shop, or I eat to feel okay. You know, and I'll tell you now, standing here fast or sober, if I couldn't feel okay and I walked on, I wouldn't be here. You know, that's actually the truth. I'm a feel-good kind of girl. Like, I need to be okay. You know, and if I had to come to AA and hold on and think about drinking every day and, you know, not be okay with myself, I wouldn't be here. Because that wouldn't cut it for me. You know, and what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous is like this absolute life of freedom. You know, this life where, you know, drink really isn't a big deal. It's there, it's not there, whatever. You know, and you guys aren't really a big deal. You guys have opinions, you guys judge, you know, like, that's okay, whatever. You know, and I'm just here and I'm okay and whatever. You know, and I'm learned that that's the position of neutrality. You know, which first I find we come across with a drink. We fall into a position of neutrality with a drink. And I found that actually sober, I fall into a position of neutrality with life. You know, you know, when I first got sober, I thank God for the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was, you know, sworn. I walked away right from jail, and, you know, I had this moment of clarity where I decided not to go back to Connecticut and to stay in Florida, and I just knew intuitively in my gut that if I went back to Florida, I was going to drink, and if I drank, I was going to die, you know, and so I came to AA in Florida. I went to a clubhouse that I'd been brought to in treatment a couple months prior, and I think I said maybe one of the first honest things I said. You know, I just raised my hand and I was like, I'm homeless and new and terrified. I really want to drink. You know, and the women in Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded me. You know, they sheltered me, they loved me, they fed me. You know, and they also instantly got me a bottle service, you know, which I think saved my ass. You know, I remember being at the July 4th picnic, like a month out of jail, and I'm counting like thousands of dollars. And in my head, I'm like, these people are crazy. Like, what are they doing trusting me with their money? Like, I am a spelling, crackhead, drunk, homeless person, you know? Like, there was no logic to me counting that money. You know, what I found is that there's really not much logic to those principles. You know, and these women and men intuitively knew that I needed to be involved with service. I needed to be thinking about something other than myself and something other than alcohol. You know, or else I might leave. And I actually believe that that saved my life. You know, however, what I also believe is I believe that the woman who first watched me was not a real alcoholic. I believe that, you know, I had a lot of animosity about that, actually. In fact, I spoke here at an act of recovery probably when I was about 2 years sober, and I said something unkind of towards him from the podium, and like caught myself, and there was like a large moment of silence. You know, I actually believe that she's an angel that was put in my life. However, what happened is, you know, they told me to find someone who had what I wanted. She was 16 years sober, she had a convertible and a fiance, and I was like, that's pretty sweet. You know, I want that. And, you know, what happened is I started getting worse. You know, and I've already told you that I'm a solution driver, and the problem is me. That I am broken and not okay. So if you're anything like me, and you get sober, you do not get better, you get worse. You know, and you know, I'm a couple months sober, and I'm throwing tantrums in the halfway house I've gotten into. I am stealing from the girls in the halfway house. I am, like, policing the people in the supermarket, like, making sure they have 10 items before they go into the supermarket. And people are, like, raising their eyebrow at me and looking at me and being like, do you even work at Publix? And I'm like, no, I am not okay. I am suicidal, homicidal, maniacal. I am not okay. You know, and I'm going to a lot of AA, though. You know, I'm going to a lot of AA. And I'm hearing you guys, you know, talk about God. And I'm hearing you guys talk about the steps. And I'm hearing you guys talk about inventory. And so being the go-getter that I am, I decide that I'm going to do these steps. And I start writing my own inventory, which if you have not written an inventory, I highly suggest you do it. But with a sponsor who's going to bring you through the big book. There are specific directions. And I was just writing zigzag up and down, going back to things, and the next. You know, but I went to my sponsor, and I very proudly displayed this inventory I've been writing. And she looked at me, and she was like, honey, I don't think I can help you. I think you're sicker. You know, than me, and you need to go elsewhere. One, thank God she had the humility to say that and not pretend that she was going to be able to help me. You know, and what happened is that event transpired a series of events that today I can only say are, you know, littered with God's fingerprints. You know, and I went to a young person's meeting that night, and the woman was speaking, the woman that I heard several months back while I was in treatment, and I had identified with, and I went up to her after, and I, you know, threw up on her, and was like, I don't have a sponsor, and just my sponsor just fired me, and she told me I was sick, and I'm writing my own inventory, and I mean, you can only imagine, like, if you think I fucked up now, you know. You know, this woman was not accepting sponsors at the time, but she said, you know what, like, you really need help, I'm going to help you. And she said a couple simple things to me that made no sense to me at the time, you know, but she said, like, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, yes, not because I was, just because I wanted her to like me, you know, and she asked me if I could follow a couple of simple directions, and I said yes, not because I thought I would be able to, just because I wanted her to like me. You know, and then she said a couple other things. You know, she very promptly told me that, you know, she was not my mother, my guru, my banker. You know, she was none of those things. That her job was to take me through these 12 steps that they were outlined in the big book, and to take my hand and put it into God's hand, so I could do that for another person. And she made me promise at that point that if she went through these 12 steps with me, that I would go through them with other girls. And again, I said, okay, not having any idea what the heck she was talking about. You know, just wanting her to like me. You know, and what I will say to you, you know, if you're new here, that my prayer for you is that you're broken. You know, and that you're in so much pain that it hurts. You know, and I don't say that because I have any malice or ill will towards you. You know, I say that because you know, I know if you suffer from the alcoholic ego that I have, that unless you're broken, you're not willing to surrender. You know, and my experience when I got here is that I was so broken that that translated into being so willing. You know, and if you had told me to get naked and, you know, do somersaults down Atlantic Avenue, pushing a peanut with my nose, you know, while singing opera, you know, I would have done it. Like, that's how broken I was. You know, and if anyone told me to do that, seek counsel elsewhere, you know. But that's the level of surrender and willingness I had. You know, I was out of ideas, and I was seemingly hopeless, and I wanted what you guys had. And it wasn't the fiancé or the convertible or the 16 years anymore. It was the look you guys had in your eyes. You know, you guys had bright, shiny eyes. You guys were vibrant and alive, and you guys laughed from your bellies. And I can't remember the last time I laughed from my belly. You know, I just had this flicker of hope. You know, and I'm just finding that big book is supposed to seemingly hopeless. Because seemingly means it only appears that way. Because if we were actually hopeless, there would be no hope. There would be no hope for recovery. And my experience is that through these 12 steps, I've recovered from this hopeless state of mind. You know, I'm not going to talk about each of the steps in depth because I want to tell you a little bit about the last 6 years. But you know, I will tell you that each of them was pivotal, and that my experience through the years with each of them has also changed. You know, my understanding of the third step when I first got sober was like, get on your knees, say this prayer, and put pen to paper. Like, that was my understanding of the third step when I first got sober. The longer I stay sober, you know, the third step has become about, you know, am I being more of a giver than a taker? You know, am I showing up and serving God's kids in AA and outside of AA? You know, and, because the real deal is between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer, not the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. And, you know, the third step has become about, like, my life is really none of my business. You know, which doesn't mean that I don't take proactive action and that I pay my rent and that I, you know, work hard in school. It's not what it means. Like, it just means that my first priority is serving God's kids. And I do my best, and I'm not in the results business. And if my first priority is serving God's kids, everything kind of seems to work out. You know, not always the way I think it should, but everything just seems to work out. You know, and it says in the promises after the third step, you know, if you do work God's work well, you know, you will be taken care of. I don't necessarily always do God's work well, but I do it to the very best of my ability, tirelessly. And as a result, I hope you've been taken care of. You know, there's been some times which have very much seemed like I was not being taken care of, you know. But again, I look forward and I understand backwards. And in hindsight, it's exactly where I was supposed to be, and everything was exactly as it was supposed to. You know, and so, you know, my sobriety, I don't know if it has a normal progression or not. You know, I got very involved with AA. You know, I'm a doer. And so, you know, people talk about, you know, being so scared to sponsor their first sponsee. I was freaking pumped. Like, I was so excited. Like, I remember that when I didn't have a car, I would, like, you know, walk and, like, have my headphones on and I'd be daydreaming. And, like, I would be daydreaming about, like, my 25-year sobriety acceptance. Coins. Like, that's the way I was, you know, and it also speaks to, like, my incredible ego, you know, but I was just jazzed about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I wanted to, like, stand on the rooftops and, you know, yell that I was sober. I wanted to go into the bars and the crack houses and, like, pull you guys out and, you know, move you into my house and, you know, I was just on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous and deeply in the trenches, and, thank God, you know, like, thank God, like, what an invigorating, life-changing, you know, experience I had, you know, helping a lot of people, you know, be in a service, and I just living a life that I didn't even know was possible months prior, you know. What I will tell you is that I was full of arrogance and ego, and I was a girl with, you know, 16 months sober, yelling at the guy who's 30 years sober because he introduced himself as a recovering alcoholic. And I was like, don't you understand? We're recovered. It says it. Like, just crazy stuff. And I mean, I do believe that we, if you work the 12 steps, can be a recovered alcoholic. But who the hell am I? You know? Like, I thank God for the sponsorship that was like, Mary, Alcoholics Anonymous is just fine on May 6th, 2007. You, on the other hand, were not. You know, like, you know, and that's the truth. I was jumping a freight train with a box of wine, you know, with my treatment boyfriend about to get arrested. I was not okay on May 6th, 2007. You know, and what began to happen is I really began to feel like I was clean of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I knew better than all you guys, you know, what began to happen as a result of that is I began to live a double life. And the big book talks about the alcoholic lives a double life. There's a character that we want you guys to think, but a reputation that we don't deserve. And my experience is that's not just drinking. You know, that's dead cold sober. You know, because I care so much about what you guys think about me that I'm scared to tell you all the truth. You know, and I also believe we're a product of our first sponsor. And my first sponsor didn't share much with me about how she struggled. You know, she was always smiling, and it was always solutions. You know, and so what I took from that, and I only realized this in hindsight from inventory, what I took from that is that in order to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a sponsor, a woman of grace and dignity, I need to be okay all the time. You know, and I'm not okay all the time. You know, at 2 years sober, I was in an abusive relationship. I was, you know, I maybe was feeling like, I was not okay, you know, but I was too ashamed to tell you guys because I was terrified of your judgment, you know, because I was still relying on you guys to make me feel okay, you know, and what happened is that, you know, I began to be in a lot of pain. And the obsession has been removed. You know, I haven't wanted to drink since then. However, I have wanted to die sober. You know, I've been in the fetal position wanting to die because I'm in so much pain. You know, and what I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I believe, personally, my opinion, AA has not, and I have a lot, my opinion is that my disease is alive and it's smart and it knows what I'm doing and how to get me. You know, so to tell me, hey, you should have a drink, that sounds like a good idea, is stupid. Because I'll be like, no, I don't want a drink, and move on. However, to tell me that you guys don't get me is a smart move. Because I'll buy that delusion. You know, I'll buy that, you know, you guys are judging me, or that I'm not good enough to be a part of, or that, you know, I can't do X, Y, and Z and be a member. And what I know about my disease is if I get far enough away from you guys, then it will tell me it's a good idea to drink. And I might buy that. You know, so you know, 2-3 years sober, I wanted to die. And, you know, God is just so marvelous. You know, and somehow the people that you need to have put in front of you are always put in front of you. And what happened is this, I saw this woman, you know, speak at the podium, and she asked me all the years, and she was honest about being crazy. You know, that's the truth. And she was honest about things that she'd done sober that were not necessarily supposed to be done. And I was attracted to that. You know, and Bill Wilson writes, you know, he writes, you know, as brothers in Alcoholics Anonymous, we are not attracted to each other through our perfections, or attracted to each other through our imperfections. You know, and I didn't know that. You know, you don't know what you don't know until you know it. And what happened is this woman started to respond to me, and she shared things with me, you know, that are in the 12 and 12, but she shared things with me like, you know, that I was too sick. You know, that I literally was powerless over alcohol, and I was living in a 12 step, and I was sponsoring a bunch of girls. And she pointed out to me the very painful truth that sponsorship is a human power. You know, which I didn't get until I got. You know, really what this deal here in Alcoholics Anonymous is about is about seeking a relationship with God and serving Him, her, it, whatever you call it. You know, and certainly that comes across in sponsorship. You know, but for me, I was sponsoring this gaggle of girls in order to feel okay. Well, I was not okay. And, you know, the next couple of years of my sobriety began to be about was really the causes and conditions of my spirituality. really how fear was paralyzing me and motivating me. You know, really how my, you know, my knowledge that, you know, this illusion that, like, what you guys think about me matters and defines me was crippling me. And there were a lot of painful inventory and a lot of tears. You know, my heart began to soften a little bit. You know, and I began to start being honest with you guys in a different way. You know, I'm sure some of you guys did judge me. You know, but that's okay. You know, it's okay. Because I no longer needed your validation to be okay. I need validation because I was hurting my heart with God. And what also happened over those couple of years is I softened in Alcoholics Anonymous also. You know, you know, I used to hate people that didn't work out of the big book. You know, I used to think they were like poisoning Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the truth is, that belief is poisoning me. You know? People don't hurt people here in Alcoholics Anonymous maliciously for the most part. You know, people do the best they can with what they have. You know, we transmit what we have. You know, I stopped sponsoring 30 girls. You know, I stopped speaking at every meeting. I stopped chairing every meeting. I stopped quoting the book verbatim. You know, and more importantly, I attempted to stop judging the people who did those things or didn't do those things. You know, and it became about being a part of you guys. You know, not better and not worse. You know, just a part of you guys. And which is so hard for me. It's so hard for me to be a member amongst members, you know, to be a worker amongst workers, to be a student amongst students. You know, it's so hard for me. You know, and I'll just say in the last couple minutes that I have, you know, this ride has been fucking wild, you know? I just moved to New Jersey about 9 months ago, and, you know, after living in an ashram for 9 months, which if you don't know what that is, it's like a hippie yogic community. And, who would have thought? You know, like when I walked in here, I was a homeless, you know, mean-spirited, like, junky, crackhead, drunk prostitute. Like, that's who I walked in here as. You know, and the life I lived today, it's not beyond my wildest dreams, but my wildest dreams are pretty wild, you know? But my life today is a life that I didn't even know I wanted. I never thought I deserved. And you know, the best life I've ever had is yet to come. You know, I've never had it so good, and the best is yet to come. And you know what I'll close with? It's because, you know, a lot of my sobriety has absolutely been painful. You know, I had a sponsor who once, I would call him up and I would tell him my woes, and he'd be like, have you thanked God for this yet? And I hated him. I was like, you didn't hear me. I just told you that he's cheating on me, you know? And like, what I find, not always in the moment, is that everything in my life has served a purpose. The pain, the strife, the uncomfortability, as well as the joy and the victory and the triumph. You know, all of them have served a purpose. And, you know, without the bad times and without the pain, I wouldn't be able to appreciate the good times and the joy that I feel. And, you know, I'll just close with saying that, like, we are imperfect people, you know, and that's okay. You know, if I wasn't imperfect, I wouldn't have a reason to keep coming back. And I think I'm going to keep coming back. Okay.